attorneys who have appeared with us before. William C. Wolford, Assistant Attorney General, representing David Schwartz. Mr. Wolford.
May it please the Court. This case is here on the petition for review of Administrator Schwartz. And the background of the case is as follows. In 1996, Mr. Kaminsky was found guilty of second-degree sexual assault of a child after a plea of guilty in Triple Elk County Circuit Court. The court imposed and stayed a 10-year sentence and placed Kaminsky on probation for 10 years. He served a year in the county jail as a condition of probation. In January of 98, Kaminsky was given a standard set of probation rules. In March of 98, he was convicted of misdemeanor battery and he was placed on probation. That probation was subsequently revoked and he was incarcerated in the Chippewa County Jail. Kaminsky was scheduled to be released from jail on December 19, 1998. He was going to be moving into a trailer in a trailer park, so he was given special sex offender rules on December 18, 1998. These rules included Rule 16-25, which stated, "You will notify the neighbors on each side that you are a convicted sex offender by December 24, 1998. On December 28, 1998, Kaminsky was taken into custody for investigation of alleged violations of the terms of his probation. The Department of Corrections subsequently sought to revoke his probation for three rule violations. The administrative law judge found that he had violated two of the three rules, including the rule which required Kaminsky to notify his neighbors that he was a convicted sex offender, and revoked his probation. Kaminsky's administrative appeal failed. He filed a certiorari action in the circuit court, and the revocation was affirmed. He then appealed to the Court of Appeals. The Court of Appeals, in a 2-to-1 decision, reversed the judgment of the circuit court, including that the DOC could not revoke probation based on a failure to comply with a rule requiring Kaminsky to notify his neighbors that he was a convicted sex offender, because it is inconsistent with Section 301.46 of the statutes. The Court of Appeals remanded the case for a determination as to whether the remaining violation is sufficient to warrant revocation. This court then granted the respondent's petition for review. Our first position is that the probation rules serve the goals of probation. It has long been established under Wisconsin law that the validity of conditions of probation are tested by how well they serve the dual goals of probation, rehabilitation and protection of the community.
Counsel, is this a condition, you said conditions of probation, is this a condition of probation or is this a rule of probation, and how do you determine the difference?
Well, it is a rule of supervision that was required by the Department of Corrections. They define in Chapter DOC 328, Section 328.03, Parent 11, they say conditions means specific regulations imposed on the client by the court or department. So it is a regulation or a rule imposed by the, not a regulation, but a rule imposed by the DOC, but they define it as a condition, and I think it is a condition, it's just not imposed by the court.
What is their authority to adopt these rules, which they consider conditions of probation?
Well, the...
They need statutory authority.
Sure. The statute, 973.10 gives them authority to administer probation.
Well, that's true, but Where does that give them authority?
It shall subject the defendant to the imposition of probation shall have the effect of placing the defendant in the custody of the Department of Corrections, and shall subject the defendant to the control of the department under conditions set by the court and rules and regulations established by the department for the supervision of probationers.
Are there any limits on the kinds of rules that the department can set up?
Well, there. One of the limits is, this is indicated in a Court of Appeals case from a few years ago, State Ex Rel Taylor versus Linz, 161 West 2nd 719, which basically says that that there's a conflict between conditions of probation established by the court and rules and established by the Department of Corrections to administer, the court rules will prevail. Otherwise, I think that generally the you look to the same principles in determining whether the rule is appropriate, whether it serves the dual goals of the probation.
It cannot conflict with a statute.
Correct.
Okay. And that's the issue here.
Right.
So it's a double step. Three. One, the rule can't conflict with a condition set by the court. Two, the rule can't conflict with a statute. And three, the rule has to be for the benefit of the grounds for probation or parole.
Right. And we contend in this case that requiring a sex offender to disclose to his immediate neighbors that he's a convicted sex offender does serve both the goals of probation, and I've cited some cases on pages 11 and 12 of my brief that support that proposition. Now, the Court of Appeals concluded that the probation rule in question was contrary to 301.46. That's the reason that they
statute
determined it wasn't appropriate. We disagree with this conclusion. The authority of the DOC to require Kaminsky to notify his neighbors that he's a convicted sex offender derives from its general authority to supervise the probationer during the probationary period. That's an authority that existed long before the sex offender registration and notification laws were enacted. One of the responsibilities of the probation agent in supervising the probationer is to protect the public. As I indicated in the appendix in my brief, the final report of the DOC Community Notification Work Group, which is contained in the drafting file for 1995 WIS Act 440, indicated that probation and parole sometimes used extended notification within the neighborhood for cases supervised under a high-risk caseload. So the legislature was aware of this existing practice when they first implemented community notification. Now, as Judge Hoover recognized in his dissent in the Court of Appeals, there's nothing in the registration law's history or express language to indicate a legislative intent to limit the authority of DOC to impose conditions of probation that are otherwise reasonable and appropriate, including notification where deemed warranted. The Court of Appeals and Kaminsky interpret the sex offenders laws as having a purpose to severely restrict access by the general public to information about sex offenders. That this is not the legislative purpose is indicated by the recent amendments to the laws under 1999 WIS Act 89, which requires the DOC to provide internet access to information.
But that amendment would indicate that the goal was to keep it limited. And because the statute is limited, now you have to amend it to increase circulation of the information.
I think the law is continually being amended, and I think it's...
And one assumes to change it.
Yes, they're changing it and providing easier access.
That's right, which would mean it was limited access before.
I guess that would be one conclusion.
One interpretation.
Yes. The Court of Appeals noted the concern about limited access to the sex offender registry and about intrusive notification expressed in the drafting notes of the sex offender notification laws as discussed in this court's Bowling decision. A review of those drafting materials shows that the concern was about the amount of information provided as well as to whom the information was provided. These concerns are not implicated by the notification which was provided here. First, the members of the public who were notified were limited. Kaminsky was only required to advise the neighbors on each side in the trailer park that he was a convicted sex offender.
How long do you think it would take for the whole trailer park to know?
It's certainly possible that it would spread, but there was no door-to-door flyers. There was no mass media release.
No, it would be done just by the neighbors talking, which is even better than the flyers, because everybody listens to gossip. They don't necessarily read the flyers.
The point is, though, that it was limited to people that had the most need for that information, as opposed to broadcasting it to many people that perhaps would have no need for it.
Well, are you saying that if this rule, instead of saying that you had to tell your neighbors, said you had to tell everybody in the trailer park, would that have been okay?
At some point you draw a line. I'm not sure if the law line is drawn there, but I think one of the factors that you consider in deciding this is how tailored the notice was, and I think this was very tailored.
You don't think two trailers down from the defendant's home would also be tailored? I mean, you're not talking about that much space. It's easily walkable if it's the kind of trailer park I'm thinking about.
I think one of the values of this particular rule is that these people are in close proximity to the trailer, and if they know what the situation is, they're somewhat able to monitor and determine if perhaps children are visiting the trailer where they shouldn't be visiting, whereas people that live a long ways away are not able to do that.
So about the trailer in front or in back?
I think that the information, the access that was provided could have been broader and still be permissible. The information provided was also limited. He was only required to tell his neighbors that he was a convicted sex offender. Members of the public received more information under the sex offender's laws than Kaminsky was to provide here. If you look at Section 301.45, Paren 2, Section 301.46, Paren 5, Paren B, if you're getting information under the sex offender law, more information is disclosed than was disclosed here. So the probation condition was tailored to the particular offender and circumstances.
Now, subsection 5 of 301.46, as I read it anyway, would have allowed the probation agent to go to the sheriff or to the police chief and ask the police chief or the sheriff to do this. Isn't that correct?
Yes.
And the police chief or sheriff could have done it.
I didn't hear the
The police chief or sheriff could have then done exactly what the probation agent wanted. What strikes me is that this statute seems to be narrowly drawn to essentially provide that the sheriff or the police chief is the conduit through which this information is disseminated. Subsection 5 makes no reference whatsoever to a probation agent. It seems to me that the probation agent, in your case, is taking on the role of the police chief or the sheriff. How do you respond?
Well, I have several responses to that. One, it's not in the record, and I do not know why the probation agent didn't do exactly that. I can speculate that she didn't think that she had to, and she felt, I know more about this person I'm supervising than the police chief or the sheriff. Yes, under the sex offender law, it is... It does go through the police chief and and the sheriff. But our point here is that this law applies to many, many people that are not being actively supervised by the Department of Corrections. It applies to some people for 15 years after their discharge. It applies to some people for life. When you're talking about people that are not being actively supervised by the Department of Corrections, this is the procedure that is followed. There is a balancing process here, and this is designed to provide this sort of access in that sort of situation. We're saying when there is active supervision, though, this is not the exclusive means. Well, the other point I would make about the statute is under 301.45(7A), there's a confidentiality provision, and it's referred to in the Court of Appeals decision. It's referred to by Mr. Kaminsky. That provision, however, has an exception that says, except as needed for law enforcement purposes. And we believe that disclosure to a probationer's neighbor that he's a convicted sex offender in order to protect the public fits within that law enforcement purposes exception. There's also an exception under that provision for being provided under 301.46, which includes the provision you're talking about.
Sorry, where is that exception?
This is 301.45(7)(A).
That's under the statutes, you say.
Right.
Okay.
Well, what if a deputy sheriff or a police officer decided that in his or her judgment the neighbor should be notified? Would they be able to do so because they felt that this was in the best interest of the public, protect the public?
The police chief or the sheriff?
No,
I'm sorry.
Deputy.
Oh.
Or a police officer, sergeant. I mean, who can take this law into their own hands, I guess, is what I'm asking.
Well, I haven't thought about that question. I guess my immediate reaction would be an assistant could do it if authorized by the police chief or the sheriff, but not without that authorization. It doesn't have to be the actual chief doing the disclosure, but it has to be authorized.
The conduit has to be the sheriff or the police chief.
Right.
Could I ask a threshold question? Why is it that the sex offender registration law has anything whatsoever to do with what are and are not proper rules of probation in the first place?
I don't think it does. But that's what the Court of Appeals concluded. I think that authority existed before this law, and I don't think there's anything in the history that indicates that there was any intent to change the law as far as the authority of the Department of Corrections probation agents to do their job. They have the responsibility and the duty to protect the public, and if in a particular circumstance they think that is needed to provide some sort of notification, I think that they have the right to do it.
The rule of probation imposed in this case, and which was the subject of the revocation, did not say the defendant must disclose his sex offender registration information to his neighbors. It just said that he had to disclose his status as a sex offender to his neighbors, right?
Yeah, it says he has to disclose he's a convicted sex offender. One could argue, and I think reasonably so, that when they're talking about convicted sex offender, they're not necessarily even talking about what the definition of a sex offender is for purposes of 301.45 and 46.
And his status as a convicted sex offender is a matter of public record anyway, right?
Yes, that's right.
And the registration law requires the defendant to register with the state and also to provide all kinds of information about what kind of car he drives, where he works, where he goes to school, what his movements are, you know, identify all kinds of additional information beyond his status as a convicted sex offender.
Much more extensive than what was required in this case. There was nothing about what kind of car you drive or where I work or anything of that sort. That's correct.
Could I ask you, you referred to the special sex offender rules. How far do they go back?
The special sex offender rules, I think what you're referring to are a set of rules, the second set of rules that were issued for Mr. Kaminsky. And this is, some of this is in the record, some of it isn't. If you look at that second set of rules that are in the record, they indicate at the bottom that they were prepared by somebody, I think, in the Milwaukee office or whatever, and I believe they may have become effective in 1998. Those are some additional rules that were developed by somebody in DOC that they started using at some point in sex offender cases. They weren't available, I think, initially at the time that he was first put on probation. The specific rule we're talking about here is not one of those rules. It was a rule that was written out in hand, and my understanding, this is not in the record, my understanding is that this was something that was available to agents to use on a case-by-case basis and wasn't part of that written set of special sex offender rules.
Okay, let's just look at that. That's in the record. And it says on a 130-98, there are a series of rules. This is all printed, so it's formatted there. Everybody, I assume, unless something is particularly stricken. And 16 says you shall follow any specific rules that may be issued by an agent to achieve the goals and objectives of your supervision. The rules may be modified at any time as appropriate. The specific rules imposed at this time are stated on the back of this form. You'll place your initials so that you show it, and then there are five handwritten on the back, right? That's dated 130-98. Then on something dated, this exhibit 3, dated 12-18-98, it is again a printed form, and it says 16-1, and it's down to 16-16. And then it goes on to 16-17 through 23, all printed. And then there's some 16-19 says, you shall not possess any photographs or other pictures of people under 18 without approval, but you can have family members. That's and then again, family members 16-20. 16-22 and 23 are stricken. That says you can't leave Milwaukee County and you have to maintain a log about your daily activities. Then 16-24 is handwritten, right? All previous rules apply.
Right.
And this is, because this is dated, there are two dates on this, 11-18 and 12-18. And then...
I think that is a 12. It looks like an 11, but I think that is in fact a 2.
That may be. That would then fit. Okay. 16-24 says all previous rules apply. That must be a reference to the 130-98. And then 25 is written in. So the department can issue rules, but now you're saying the agent can issue specific additional rules?
My understanding is that...
I mean, that's what 16-25
This was a rule that was used from time to time in the discretion of the agent. It was available. It was not one of these special sex offender rules. Whether or not one has to obtain the approval of the supervisor, I'm not certain about that.
Oh, but so it's not printed somewhere in a list that says the department authorizes the following rules.
It may be, but it wasn't part of these sex offender rules. I'm not certain about that.
Now, as to the registration, all this information under the registration, that has to be kept confidential, right? That's not open to the neighbors, right? That's under 2B. B2B. I'm sorry, 6B. The penalty. Under 30145, sex offender registration.
We're talking about, what section?
Subsection 7 says maintain information provided under 2 is confidential. Which is all this information about your name, address, location, school, all the information that's been previously referred is confidential, right? Under the statute.
Right.
Okay.
With those exceptions.
So the issue is, it seems to me, that the relation of 45 to this, to the rules here is the legislature has said in 30145 that information is about a sex offender is confidential. And now the question is, does that mean when you interpret the department rules, the rules are invalid or valid because they're violating a confidentiality rule?
Well, as I argued before, we think that under that particular provision, that exception for as needed for law enforcement purposes would apply to a probation agent providing rules of supervision for somebody they're supervising.
Okay, but with law enforcement, you don't mean for purposes of law enforcement. You mean for purposes of probation, because the probation officer is not a law enforcement officer.
No, I'm not contending that the probation agent is a law enforcement officer, but I think they're engaging in law enforcement functions. Law enforcement functions are not limited to investigating crime. They include preventing crime. We know police engage in community caretaker functions. They're trying to do their job to protect the public, and rehabilitate, and that's...
Chief, if I may, are you suggesting then that anyone who's engaging in a law and in an activity which promotes law enforcement purposes falls within that exception?
If the department determines that it's needed for law enforcement.
There are these community watch groups that are see themselves and perhaps are adjunct to law enforcement, you know, neighborhood watch stuff.
I don't think that it would apply to someone that was not a governmental agency. There is a specific provision dealing with community watch as far as access.
Except as needed for law enforcement purposes, who would that apply to other than the Sheriff's Department and the Police Department?
I think it applies to the probation agent supervising a probationer. That's what we're suggesting.
So you're putting them under law enforcement.
What do you do with the probation search cases, then?
No.
That was the point of my question, though. Justice Babbage and then Justice Bronson.
As I understand it, this police chief or sheriff does not have authority to go out and give notification to neighbors under the statute. The neighbor has to come to them. Isn't that correct?
No, I don't believe that's the case.
Well, under sub 5, it says the department, sheriff may provide the information who has not provided notice under or access under sub 4, if in the opinion of the department, providing the person requesting the information does all of the following. Sounds to me like they've got to request it and then have to jump through some hoops before they can get this information.
And 4 specifically says which entities may request. Sub 4. Mm-hmm.
Well, I know in some instances they do some mass meetings, that type of thing, to people who have not specifically requested the information. I think that is perhaps 301.46. Paren 2, Paren E. It's a complicated statute, but I think
so you're saying there it's entitled to request, even if they haven't requested.
Right.
But again, 2E says to any person requesting information.
Or to members of the general public.
You're right, or to members of the general public.
But again, it's limited to police chief and sheriff.
Yes, that provision is. Yes.
Thank you. I'm sorry, Justice Prosser had a question. He'll ask it in the last 5 minutes of your rebuttal. Mr. Lang?
Sorry, Dave, I jumped in. May it please the court, Don Lang appeared on behalf of Carl Kaminsky, who is the appellate respondent, I guess, at this stage of the process. First of all, I should start by saying that the remedy we're asking for today is not to cut Mr. Kaminsky loose. The remedy here is to affirm the judgment of the Court of Appeals, which basically concludes that the rule used to revoke him, at least one of the grounds, is invalid. The remedy would be remand.
I'm just going to interrupt you a moment, since there's such quizzical looks about the court's amusement. Yesterday, Mr. Lang appeared for a different sex offender, and the remedy there he was asking for was to release the sex offender. So he's just trying to tell us that the offender is released. Go ahead.
Well, the offender at this point is a 10-year prison term. I mean, he only gets released if, after reviewing again the merits of the department's, the Plotkin analysis, I guess they call it, whether or not under the totality of the circumstances he should nonetheless be revoked.
Is the one violation sufficient to sustain the Plotkin analysis for revocation?
It may be, may not be. It's up to the department, considering all the factors, to decide that. And
what
we don't know at this point is whether this one was the determinative factor that struck the balance. Excuse me, I'm sorry.
You're going to ask the department to release them?
Ultimately, yes.
Okay.
Releasing back to probation.
Right.
Can I ask you the threshold question that I asked your counterpart about why it is that the sex offender registration law has anything whatsoever to do with
absolutely
probation?
That is, I guess, the principal question, really. And there's no question the department, administering rules and regulations to govern probation, has tremendous power and has tremendous discretion in formulating these. But its authority derives from the legislature, and likewise, its authority is restricted by the legislature. And some of these are so obvious we don't even think of them this way, but they're no doubt true. It's sort of reflected in the Fearing case, which I submitted. And that is, an agent in good faith could say, this guy really should do more condition time. I think he needs the confined setting. It could be a reasonable thought process, but the legislature simply doesn't afford the agent the power to do that. That the court only sets conditions of probation, jail time, and the agent can't, even though he or she may think that's reasonable, apply that condition. Agent can't extend the length of probation. The agent can't impose restitution, even if the agent thinks, gee, I think this person should pay and accept responsibility, that I think this will rehabilitate them. I mean, they may be all sound judgments, but the legislature has confined the authority within certain constraints. Those constraints are in the statutes.
Well, where is that in this statute? In other words, in looking at this, there doesn't seem to be any provision that would say this is the, quote, exclusive method to handle. It would just seem to me, just common sense, that when you have dozens or hundreds of people out on probation, that each person, each setting might call for some individual considerations by the agent as far as the protection of the public. So I get this under the dissent. Hoover seems to indicate that there's nothing in the registration's law history or express language to indicate a legislative intent to limit the authority to impose conditions of probation that are otherwise reasonable and appropriate.
Well, I guess my answer to that is the entire scheme is inconsistent with that conclusion. That argument almost, I think, is dubious under a lot of situations, but it's particularly dubious when you have a legislative scheme that's so detailed, so painstakingly crafted, is so particular about who can release information, when they can release information, what information they can release, that to suggest that somehow the legislature would just assume while the department can keep doing this is just incompatible with that scheme.
I think the legislature was talking about people that were, as mentioned by opposing counsel, not under supervision, people that were not involved as much as perhaps Mr. Kaminsky. So it just seems to me to be common sense and reason that you can't, one size doesn't fit all, and an agent would be able to have rules and regulations, and certainly I can't find anything, at least it doesn't seem to me, that how this would violate, since this is a matter of public record, his conviction's a matter of public record, what are we talking about here?
Well, it's my position that this legislation, as detailed and extensive as it is, has in effect occupied the field of disclosure of sexual offender information.
But it doesn't say that, does it? It doesn't say
no.
Probation and all probation should, is, you know, agents should pay attention to this. And this is it. This, you have to work within these confines.
Well, I think it does indirectly, and this is the way it happens. One is, there's a general provision of confidentiality under the one subsection, which is a catch-all.
Confidentiality of what?
Of the information contained in the registry.
Confidentiality of the registry, not confidentiality of the defendant's status as a sex offender, which is a matter of public record.
But in terms of this particular rule,
yeah,
it incorporates all this information. And essentially, this law becomes almost incidental or irrelevant if the agent can disclose routinely information that's contained therein,
well, the
which essentially is always going to be in the agent's possession.
The agent couldn't authorize release of the registry or disclosure of the registry or access to the registry except by reference to this law. But I still haven't heard an answer to my threshold question about why a law that says, okay, Department of Corrections, you must maintain this registry, and here's who has to register, and here's the information they have to supply, and it's got a whole bunch of stuff well beyond the defendant's status as a sex offender. And then in the second section, 301.46, it says here's who gets access to the registry, either automatically or by request. And why that law has anything whatsoever to do with an agent's ability to craft rules of probation for the protection of the public, I still haven't heard an answer to.
Well, the answer is that the legislature's determined that release of this type of information comes in a particular methodology and by certain people, and that, in effect, for the agent to be able to do this independently would undermine the entire scheme.
Where does it say that the legislature has said that release of this type of information? The legislature has said that access to the registry is going to be governed by these rules. The legislature hasn't said that release of someone's status as a sex offender, which is a matter of public record, cannot be disclosed except by reference to this statute. That's not what the statute says.
Well, if that were the case, it seems to me there would be no need for the legislature in specifying who could disclose information to have listed the department as a separate entity.
Well,
in fact, it wasn't included originally, and then they elected to include it at a later point in time.
Let me just ask you this. Look under subsection 2. It says, what information must be provided? A, the department maintains a registry of all persons subject to 1, and it contains the following information. And subsection 3 says the conviction. You have to do what the statute was, so that you show you're under 1, the date of the conviction, the county, the state, if the state's not the state, the state in which the person was convicted, all of that is public record. Yet it's under 2A, and yet under 7, it says that the department shall maintain information provided under 2 and keep the information confidential, except as provided elsewhere and except as needed for law enforcement purposes, which may or may not be probation purposes, etc. So, although it's public record, and although there's other information there that's public record, the date the person was placed on probation, the date the person was or is to be released from confinement, that's all public. But I think that Justice Sykes' question raises an issue that is being struggled with across the country. When you have public information like a conviction, it is public. You can go to any court in the state and get that information, right?
Absolutely.
Great. Absolutely. Now that information may be available on the internet, so you don't have to go to the 70 plus counties in the state. Go to each county seat, each courthouse, and look up each defendant's name. You can go into the internet and find it. And you can also find out a lot of information that's up in the public record but may not be so public, like residences, social security numbers, occupations, all of which may be part of the public record in a civil or criminal case. So the bigger issue now being presented is when you can get access to this information with your fingers sitting in your own home, so that public information is now widely disseminated, should some of this information be eliminated from the internet, even though it's public, because the concepts of widely disseminating this information violates concepts of privacy?
Well, the law assumes that all these things really are true, because it allows anybody to get the information, by and large, if they're looking to get the information.
By a lot of hard work.
Not as much hard work to the extent it's now on the internet. The scheme's more the disclosure of information to the general public or to third parties who aren't seeking the information. The concern is that that information is going to incite problems both in a law enforcement sense and both for the rehabilitation for the particular person who's on probation or parole.
Mr. Lane, can I ask you another question?
Oh, sure.
As I understand it, there was another rule imposed on Mr. Kaminsky, and that rule was that before he engaged in any kind of intimate sexual relationship with an individual, that individual had to be introduced to the probation agent. would you challenge, is there authority for the department to do that?
Well, I'll tell you, and that's a very good question. Why is that different than telling his neighbors? And I think the difference is, in effect, defendant has voluntarily engaged in this relationship and has waived any claim of confidentiality. The difficulty with the neighbor is the defendant hasn't elected to have this relationship with these people. The intimate relationship, surely he has. In fact, this is, unlike most conditions of probation, this one's very peculiar because it involves a third party who hasn't elected to become part of this process. In most criminal cases, most of the things you're told to do is stay away from people, so it doesn't involve them at all. It involves the defendant. Others, you like compensate a victim who's involved in the crime, albeit not by choice. This one sort of grabs on to people out in the public, and the agent's telling this person to go to another member of the public to have a
communication. I just don't understand. Waiver? Did you say waiver?
Well, the defendant's election to have a personal relationship, which he can choose not to have, an intimate relationship, essentially, yeah, I guess would be a waiver, forfeiture of any claim of privacy he would have in this information. I think that it's a different status as opposed to members of the public.
There are all kinds of relationships between men and women in which the men don't tell the women everything about their past, and the women don't tell the men everything about their past. I mean, I don't quite see in any legal sense where statutorily in the act that you're relying on, does the Department of Corrections have authority to issue such a rule?
About the relationship?
Yeah.
Nowhere. Specifically.
So isn't it a little disingenuous to say, I don't want to release this man in the community. I just want to strike down this rule, then we'll go back to court. Well, I would think you could use exactly the same argument about the second rule.
And that my position would be they're fundamentally different. And that disclosure of information to a member of the public who's outside the intimate relationship with the defendant is in effect governed by this notification provision. That it is indeed highly detailed under which particular circumstances that can occur. To clarify a point that was raised, I guess, previously, a sheriff and police chief can tell a member of the public about the defendant's status under this provision, even without a request, if the police chief or law enforcement officer believes it's necessary to do so for the safety of the public. And it's interesting that the legislature has assigned that authority to the police chief or law enforcement officer, not the Department of Corrections. The Department of Corrections under other provisions does have authority to release upon request, but it doesn't have the authority to independently do so, an authority that was granted after the fact to the police chief and sheriff.
Could a court issue as a condition of probation this rule? Or could a court impose that time of sentencing as a condition of probation, the rule that the defendant notify his neighbors for the entire time that he's on probation? In whatever neighborhood he resides in, whenever he moves, he's got to notify his immediate neighbors, or whenever somebody moves. this law?
It's a good question. I'm not sure what the answer is.
It seems to be
obviously, there's really two parts to this. One would say, well, the notification scheme seems to occupy the field, and then the court's not authorized to do it. But the distinction here between the court and the department is the legislation itself, at numerous points, recognizes the department as a major player in this process, both as the person holding or the body holding the information, as well as the body who can, under certain circumstances, release the information. The legislation never addresses the court's role in this one way or the other, so I think one can infer that in drafting this, the legislature was aware of what the department's role could be and took that into account in drafting it. It's not clear that the legislature ever considered the court's role in the process.
Well, the department is limited by the statute in the court conditions. The court is maybe limited by the statute unless you find inherent authority under its probation control.
And I guess that's what we're derived. I guess I haven't given
that much thought. And that may raise a different issue about a branch of government versus and what its powers are in this area in addition to or in lieu of the legislature. But the department doesn't have inherent power.
No, it derives exclusively from the legislature. And again, that goes back to the question, well, what's their power? Can they do anything they want if they think it's reasonable? And the answer is no. If the legislature has constrained them in some fashion, they can't.
And so the real issue is, has the legislature constrained them? And do you read these 301, 45, and 46 as constraining? You do, I guess.
My contention is that it does constrain the department from disclosing, except in those circumstances where they've expressly authorized them to disclose. I mean, this is, again, goes back to their consideration, frankly, fairly remarkably detailed. I mean, there's five different folders over there of how this thing was put together. And one of the pressures, of course, they were operating under was the Jacob Wettering law, that the funding, law enforcement funding, was contingent on providing a law that was going to meet certain standards. And one of those standards was a confidentiality concern, and they afforded exceptions for law enforcement, or that the legislation had a designated law enforcement officer to release information. Now, what that definition entails, arguably could entail the Department of Corrections, and in effect, our legislation does include the Department of Corrections under certain specific circumstances. In effect, everybody who at some point is going to come under this law, either when they're convicted or when they're placed on parole, is going to be at some point under supervision of the Department of Corrections. It strikes me as remarkable that the legislature, in drafting this provision, if they thought that agents were independently authorized to go out and release this information, that they wouldn't have granted or specified that authority. Obviously, the legislature didn't assume that the legislature otherwise, or the Department of Corrections otherwise, had authority to release information to the general public. The original proposal didn't include them, and they felt they had to amend it to include the department when the public requests information. Interestingly, even the Department of Corrections' own administrative code doesn't seem to construe this provision as giving them independent authority. And to the extent the administrative rules discuss the notification provision, they cite essentially the statute as in terms of their notification authority. If there were no statute, could the department disclose this information to the neighbor? Probably, yeah, probably. The problem here is the statute's occupied the field, and my position that it's occupied the field sets the limits on what the department can do. I think the department, if they feel they need more authority, their remedy is to go and let the legislature clarify that and ask the legislature to say, if a probation agent believes it is necessary for the rehabilitation and protection of the public for a probationer or parolee to disclose this information, the department may, in its discretion, do so. Could have easily done so. It does give that kind of authority to police chiefs and sheriffs. But it didn't do that in this provision. It's amended it a couple times. It still hasn't done that.
This rule directed the defendant to report to the neighbors. Is there anything else in the statute, anywhere in these sections that we're talking about, that requires the defendant to report to anybody other than to register?
The statute doesn't direct them to report to anyone but the registration. And obviously our position is for the agent to direct him to do what we feel the agent couldn't do herself or himself is a subversion of the law, that you can't order him to do something that you had no authority to do yourself. And, I mean, independent of whether the statute existed or not, it's our position that that particular rule in itself was unreasonable under these circumstances. And frankly, when I first read the record, I wasn't really that familiar with the notification law. The thing that struck me first was, what? You tell this guy to go report to the neighbors that he's a sex offender, and not knowing who he's going to meet at the door? As a citizen, I guess I'd be a little appalled if somebody came to my door and my kids answered the door and they said, well, you know, I'm Joe the molester and I live next door and I'm a convicted sex offender.
This is the same guy you didn't want living next door to you yesterday.
Well, it was suggested to me by my wife later that it, based on some of our neighbors, perhaps that wouldn't be so bad anyway.
We won't check your
information, Mr. Lang. One of the things about this legislation, in terms of directing the sheriff or the police chief to be the one to tell unrequested citizens, tell citizens rather than requesting information about someone, it really makes good sense. Because one of the concerns of this law is that it's going to incite trouble. And especially if you look at the addendums, which aren't included in the state's appendix, there's an outline of problems that occur in these circumstances. And that was one of the problems the law was designed to prevent, is somebody punches the guy in the nose because he's a sex offender, threatens him, threatens his family, all those types of problems. And obviously, in terms of the law enforcement purpose, the sheriff or police chief is probably in a better position to ascertain, you know, this guy does pose a danger, we better tell somebody. And here's the people we should tell. Likewise, they're in a better position to at least have some heads up. If this communication is going on, is there going to be a problem? And we ought to be prepared to deal with it if there is a problem. And obviously the agent's not in a position to do anything if there is a, you know, disruption caused by directing the defendant to go next door. In terms of the legislature placing limits on the department, one way to think about this particular situation is, what if the agent told good faith, and in fact this isn't really that unusual or outrageous or hypothetical, she has a sort of timid sex offender client, and the goal of course of the agents is to make sure that they are able to survive and are rehabilitated and can integrate themselves into the community. And the agent says, you know, you're going to Tombstone County with Sheriff Earp up there, and this guy's got a reputation of just hating sex offenders, and he's going to make your life so miserable, I don't think you can make it up there. So what I'm going to tell you to do is, don't register. You know, he's going to find out if you register, so just don't register. Obviously, the agent couldn't do that. They can't disregard the law. And I think the same is true here. The legislature set notification rules that are just remarkably, painstakingly specific and detailed. And the agent, in their discretion, even if it's wise discretion, can't violate those particular statutory rules. In terms of the reasonableness of this particular rule, one thing that's notable is this rule is a handwritten rule. Obviously, the department itself doesn't have this as part of their standard rules. I would be shocked if it was. In terms of going outside the record, I've never seen this before. I asked around. Nobody's seen this particular rule before. There's related rules of always with terms of intimate relationship cases of disclosing that information. But I've never seen one where you go tell a stranger who's not even part of the interaction about your sex offender status.
But you're not arguing that this rule was otherwise inappropriate, apart from your statutory argument under this rule.
Well, actually, I am. And I think it is even more inappropriate in light of the legislation. I mean, to me, that makes it even more evident that they don't even have the authority to do this. And here's the thing. If the purpose of this particular rule was to protect the public, it doesn't make any sense to send the offender, who you believe is dangerous, to the neighbor to inform them.
Well, if you believe he's dangerous, he'd still be locked up, wouldn't he?
Not necessarily. Not if he's on probation. I mean, the agent doesn't decide whether he's out or not. I mean, he's placed on probation by a court. So, the agent's stuck with whoever he gets.
But doesn't 980 at least seek to resolve that problem?
Well, that's entirely true. If the department thought he was inherently dangerous because of some mental disorder, he would have been 980-able probably at some point here.
Well, you only do that with somebody who's in prison.
Well,
this guy was put in prison.
Yeah, perhaps not. I guess it's 90 days of discharge from the prison or discharge, so he wouldn't qualify under either, at least not yet. But if the agent actually thought he was dangerous, it seems sending him over and relying on him to make the report doesn't make any sense. There is, of course, an avenue for the agent in that situation. That is, go to the sheriff. Hey, I think this guy I'm supervising is dangerous. I want you to exercise your authority under the notification rule to tell the neighbors. And that's where the legislature has given that power, is to the law enforcement officer. To the extent, oddly enough, this particular rule seems to be in conflict with other rules set by the court and the department itself. And the department says no contact with anybody under 18 years. Well, when he goes over to notify, you don't know if he's having contact with somebody under 18 years, but he's basically doing what he's being told to do, which may in effect undermine one of the prior rules that have been imposed by the court and by the department itself. If the purpose of the rule is so he owns up and somehow is rehabilitated by this, I'm not sure where the empirical data is for that particular proposition, but I mean, he sort of owned up when he pled guilty to the charge in the first place. And if owning up is important, why only the two people next door to him were his neighbors? That doesn't seem to make any sense either. And again, to own up, he would, involuntarily include neighbors or citizens who have no bearing or involvement in this case.
Well, maybe it's some kind of a shaming technique. We have judges around the state that think of, or around the country that think that shaming is a valid rehabilitation.
Well, interestingly, in terms of this notification law, the addendums include reports that indicate one of the problems with the law is it tends to undermine the ability to rehabilitate because it isolates, ostracizes, reduces self-esteem, and puts people in a position that treatment and rehabilitation tends to be more difficult. And oddly enough, in Addendum B's report on the notification law, that was one of their concerns, is if you haphazardly notify the public, you're actually going to undermine opportunities or ability to rehabilitate people. In light of that scheme, essentially, what our system has done is to provide limited disclosure. People have a right to the information if they ask for it, if they're interested enough to get it, but we're not going to go out and haphazardly basically inform members of the public and invite incitement, unless it's absolutely imperative for law enforcement purposes. And who decides whether that's the case? It's the sheriff or the police chief, not the department. And again, if the legislature devises complex scheme had thought that the department should be involved, in as much as they're obviously a major actor in this field, you'd think they would have put some provision to indicate that. And they didn't do that. They obviously recognized that they weren't necessarily incorporated in some of these notification provisions because they had to amend it to include the department in terms of notifying the public upon request. So essentially, it's our position that the rule occupies the field, the statute occupies the field of notification, the rule requiring them to go next door is in conflict with that notification rule. That rule restricts the department's authority in this context, and consequently he can't be revoked because of a violation of that rule or his unlawfulness inception. So we would ask that the judgment of the, or the decision of the Court of Appeals be affirmed.
Thank you, Mr. Lang. Mr. Wolford? Justice Crossan, do you have a question for him?
No.
Okay.
There was a suggestion that the police chief or the sheriff is in the best position to know how dangerous the offender is. I think, in fact, the agent should probably know about it, more about how dangerous the offender is than the police chief or the sheriff when you're talking about somebody just being actively supervised. Now, there's an institutional incentive not to abuse this. I've never seen one of these rules before either, and I don't think that they're going to be very common because the agent wants the probationer to be able to live in the community. The agent does not want to create hysteria, vigilanteism. That just creates more headaches for the agent. So I don't think there's a great danger of abuse here if this sort of provision is upheld. In response to a question asked by Justice Prosser to Mr. Lang about the other rule that was violated here, that a similar rule has been upheld by the Court of Appeals in the Krebs versus Schwartz case that's cited at page 11 of my brief.
Mr. Wolford, what do you think about the argument that Mr. Lang provided several times where he indicated that this law occupies the field, and because it so-called occupies the field, therefore the department has no authority in regard to a matter like this? How do you answer that?
I just don't believe it does occupy the field. And as I said, the sex offender law is very broad. It covers all sorts of people, many people that are no longer being supervised, some people for the rest of their lives. And I think probation is a different situation. And if we were talking about the same group of people, maybe you could make a strong argument that it did occupy the field, but I don't believe that it does. There was also the suggestion that the rule is just unreasonable, apart from whether it's contrary to the sex offender registration and notification law. Well, first of all, Mr. Kaminsky never complained about the rule. He just violated it. But secondly, I think we have to use a little common sense here. Mr. Kaminsky wouldn't be revoked if he went over to the neighbor's house and a child answered the door. I mean, no more than if he walked by a child on the street. That's not what the law was designed to deal with. There are all sorts of ways that he could have notified his neighbors without any concern about coming in unsupervised contact with children. And
Mr. Wolford, I want to get your position absolutely straight in my mind. Do you contest, or do you have find any? Let me start over again. Does the statute specifically allow the department to do what they did here?
Any statute?
Does any statute?
Well, it specifically.
A specific authorization.
I think that the rule that allows them to, or the statute that allows them to administer probation and establish rules to supervise probation does.
But
that isn't specific in terms of this particular rule. But
the 30145, anywhere in 30145 or 46, is the department specifically authorized?
Not specifically, except there's this confidentiality exception. There are certainly many situations where the Department of Corrections can provide information, but it's generally at the request.
So you are,
someone requests it.
You are in essence asking us to write into the statute that the department can do what the sheriff and police chief can do.
No, because it's our position that the statute doesn't limit people, the supervision of people on probation, that it wasn't meant to apply to that at all, that was already in existence and this law was not designed to change it. There was also a suggestion that the rule is unreasonable because the agent wouldn't have left it up to the to Mr. Kaminsky to do the notification because that might not ensure public protection. Well, I think there's no question the agent would have done it herself in this case if he hadn't complied, except for the fact that he was charged with a sexual assault and there's shortly thereafter taken into custody, and therefore the issue never came up.
Okay. Mr. Wallenberg, I'm sorry. Under 973.10, what speaks about, that speaks, I'm looking for it here. Under rules, under conditions set by the court and rules and regulations established by the department. Now, are you saying that a rule established by the probation officer is the same thing as a rule established by the department?
Yes.
Okay.
All right. Now, the department in the statute Justice Babbage just read to you, is that the same department as in 301.45.7? The department shall maintain information provided under sub 2?
They're both the Department of Corrections.
Okay. And then it says the department shall keep the information confidential. Same department. So you've got under 301.45 that the department has to keep the information under sub 2, which included the conviction, but they have to keep it confidential, except as needed for law enforcement purposes. And then the question is whether probation becomes law enforcement purposes, because the department has two obligations, one to make rules under the Babbage statute, and the other one is to keep this information confidential. Except if you can get under one of those exceptions. And it has to be under law enforcement. So you're saying that the probation officer is doing this under law enforcement.
Right.
Okay.
Isn't it commonplace for probation agents to have contact with the probationer's neighbors and employer, etc., in order to engage in proper supervision of the probationer?
I certainly think it is. Certainly there are many situations where an employer needs to know a background of someone to, you know, ensure there's not embezzlement or theft or something of that nature.
And so if we were to adopt Mr. Lang's construction of this statute, that would inhibit the agent's ability to have that contact with neighbors and employers and other members of the general public in order to supervise the probationer.
If you're talking about sex offenses and not with respect to other types of things, and then the question becomes, why in the world would the legislature provide more protection for sex offenders than for other people under probation?
Right, so if we construe this statute to encompass even the fact of the defendant probationer's status as a sex offender, then we have effectively shut down the agent's ability to engage in that very basic form of supervision.
That would be a very great concern.
Is there anything to preclude the agent, and I mean this, is there anything to preclude the agent from going to the chief of police and saying, Chief, would you contact those people? Is there anything that would inhibit the agent from doing that?
No, I think that is something that could be done. I mean, it's built into the the sex offender statute.
In fact, could probation officers advise the local police department when there's a probationer in the community?
I'm sorry?
Could probation officers advise the police when there is a probationer in the community?
I think they do.
Yes. That's right.
Yeah.
Thank you. That concludes our hearing on the...